everybody. My name's Paul. Welcome back. We have been doing a weekly count here, and we sort of created another commitment, I guess, unofficially, but Mark is going to tell us how many attendants we had, how many people we had in attendance tonight.
Hi, my name is Mark. We came up with a slightly different system today. What I did is I counted the number of chairs before you all got here, and then counted the empties to come up with the number and subtracted the difference. This is getting a very complicated commitment. We have a total of 180 people here tonight. We have three newcomers. Of that total of 180, 64 are women. That makes the odds 5-2. And I want all you women to just remember, the odds are good, but the goods are odd. Thank you.
We get real creative here, don't we? Okay, tonight's speaker is our own humble taping engineer, John.
I'm John. And I am your humble taping engineer. And I'm very glad to be here. And if you still can't place me, I'm the guy who rides the purple motorcycle. Thank you. I'm from up north. I was born and raised in a small town just north of Sacramento. And my father was a businessman. He ran a series of auto parts stores in that area. He was pretty well-to-do. And my mother worked for him. She was the bookkeeper. And she wasn't very happy about that. My sister is 9 years older than I am. And we all had roles in our family. We all had jobs to do. My dad's job was to be the boss. And he was secretive. He was intolerant of any kind of rebellion, and a whole lot of other things. My mother, her job was to be resentful. She was resentful because she really wanted to not live in a small town. She wanted to live near San Francisco. She wanted to be an archaeologist, and she became a bookkeeper. And my sister's role was to be the rebel, the troublemaker. And my role was to be as invisible as possible. So we had what I didn't know. When I was a child, my childhood was pretty normal. It seemed to me that everything was fine. It wasn't until I became an adolescent that things started to kind of fray around the edges. My father was a man who liked his whiskey. He drank whiskey every day. My mother was the one who drank secretly, and I didn't really know this at all. And so, you know, we all have coping strategies, and the coping strategies that I came up with were to be secretive, like my father, to lie when there was an opportunity for any kind of conflict. I also became defensive, and we also had other things that we did. We never resolved anything in my family. If there was a disagreement, it went on until it ran out of gas, and then we all just kind of tried to forget about it. But it never got resolved. One of the things my dad did was he talked about self-reliance, and he wanted me to be self-reliant, but he also wanted me to be dependent. And so he took every opportunity to kind of give me an opportunity to be dependent on him. And the way that I responded to that was I became dependent on him and also rebellious at the same time. and I became passive aggressive so that he would assign me to do something and I would screw it up. And then he would get enraged and I would become invisible. It was one of those kind of situations where you gradually are put under kind of a situation, then you respond to it. And without knowing it, I actually created ways for myself to survive in this environment. I had these coping strategies. I became secretive. I had a secret life all to my own. And, you know, I began to hate and fear authority. I've carried that forward in my life, all my life. I became manipulative. Rather than to ask for what I wanted, I figured out ways to manipulate my mother and my father to give me those things. And I grew up with a feeling of entitlement. We had a four-bedroom house on a nice piece of land, and that's what I grew up with, the feeling that I was entitled. And I expected that I would be taken care of all my life. And with that kind of background, I was all set to go out into the world. I graduated from high school, kind of drifted around. My dad told me that I should go to school. He picked out a school for me. I was lucky enough that he picked this good school, and I went to a trade school and I learned photography. It was something that I liked to do, and you know, it worked out. The thing was that I didn't really have a personality. My dad had kind of chosen for me what publicly I would do. And so when he told me that I needed to go to school, and he told me the school, I just accepted that as that's where I would go. And I did that with other things in my life. I met a woman before I left for college. She wanted to go with me, and I said, okay, that sounds like you want to do that, so I guess that's what I should do. I went through college. Later she said, well, we should get married. And I didn't really want to get married, but she said that's what she wanted to do, so I figured that's what we have to do. Later she decided that she wanted to have a kid. And I didn't really want to have kids, but you can fill out the rest. So I was kind of like Gumby a little bit, you know. You could bend me and shape me and twist me into pretty much whatever you wanted, except that I would rebel and be passive aggressive. Well, I was married. I was working. I was miserable. My wife was miserable, and we had a son. He wasn't miserable because he was too young to understand. And then a pivotal event happened to me. It's one of those things that takes your life and shifts it around and you go in a completely different direction. I decided that I was bored with my job and that I had learned some stuff about computers. So I was going to work for my dad, and I was going to computerize his business. Well, the only problem with that was I didn't know enough about computers to do that, but I just figured I could do it. We sold our house, and I moved up north, and I left first to find a place to live. My wife stayed behind. What happened when she stayed behind was she met a guy, and she started having an affair. And when it came time for us to move, we moved into this little house behind my parents' house. And my wife said, you know, I'm under a lot of stress. I got to take a couple of weeks off and see my sister. And I said, okay, I understand that. So she took off, and 2 weeks went by, and I didn't hear anything. And then a couple of days went by, and I didn't hear anything. I called her sister, and she said, well, she never showed up here. So I started calling all over the place and panicking. And after about a week, I got a phone call. my wife called and she said, I'm in love with another guy. I'm moving down in Southern California. I'm never coming back. A moving van will come and pick up this stuff. And at that point, I had supposed that my life would follow a predetermined path that I had figured out. And I had an enormous sense of denial. And when that happened, my denial system completely imploded. And I was left not only without my denial, but with no personality. And so the only thing I could think of to do was kill myself. I had an old Enfield rifle. I was looking for the bullets. And I thought, and I had written out a note. And I thought, you know, I'm going to open the phone book and I'm going to see if there's something in the phone book. And I opened up the phone book. And the page that I opened up, there was the word help. And there was a phone number next to it. And I thought, all right, I'll call that phone number. What I called was the county mental health facility. And I told them what I was thinking about doing. And they said, you know, you're only two blocks away. Why don't you walk over here? And we'll talk about it. So I walked over there, and they locked me up, you know. Which was okay, you know. And they said, now somebody wants to talk to you. And I said, okay. And they said, a therapist will talk to you. And I'd never talked to a therapist. In my family, you would never talk to a therapist. That would be crazy. So I figured, well, I'm in here, I am crazy, so why not? I talked to this woman for 5 hours without stopping. Once she had uncorked that cork, it all came out. And that was, I have enormous respect for county mental health facilities and all those therapists that work there. They are really heroic people. Saved my life. And that changed the direction that I went in. I mean, years of pain and divorce and all kinds of stuff followed. But, that set me on the path. I decided that I would move back down south. I got an offer to get my old job back. And I decided that rather than work the job as I had worked it, with a feeling of boredom and entitlement and arrogance, that I would work it with a feeling of humility, and also that I would change that job so that I had a better job. I still had terrible, terrible problems with relationships. They were a disaster, one after another. I finally had one that was so bad that I was in therapy, and the therapist said, you know, I've been listening to you for a long time now. Do you know that your mother is an alcoholic? And I said, I can't imagine that. How could that possibly be true? And he laid it out for me. He just went all the way up and down the line, and it was very clear at that point. And he said, you need to go to ACA. And I said, what is that? And he said, Adult Children of Alcoholics. So I started going to ACA meetings. And I was amazed. It was an incredible thing for me. I realized how much anger that I had towards my parents. And I began to see what had happened. And it was also the smartest move I ever made, because I met my beautiful wife. I progressed in ACA and had a lot of loving friendships there and a lot of help there. And I got to a certain point where the anger that I had was gone. And I could forgive my parents, and I could ask them for forgiveness. And I was able to work the 12 steps within that program with a wonderful sponsor. He was a man who had been a multimillionaire, and he had lost everything to alcoholism, and he'd wound up sleeping in parks. And he'd worked his way back up through AA to the point where he had an apartment and a car and a decent job. And he was a great man. And he walked me through those steps. And I found that, after a number of years, there was still something missing. I had traits that were still bothersome, that still made life difficult for my wife and myself. And I also had a deep distrust of men. The men I grew up with in my hometown were mostly mechanics. And they had all kinds of coping mechanisms within their culture. Mechanics have a culture. Just ask one. They were generally pretty sullen. They had a real macho thing going. They did a lot of posturing. And the impression I got from men were that men didn't like me, that I could never possibly be a big enough person to be on the same plane as other men. So I started going with my wife to Al-Anon meetings. And I found that program very useful. And then at some point, I think my wife suggested that I go to a men's meeting. And I went to a couple, and I found them to be kind of like clubs. They weren't terribly open. And I kept persevering, and then I found this meeting. And when I came to this meeting, we were in the non-existent building that's out there. You know, it's gone now. And we were in the long, narrow room. And when I walked in, there were a bunch of guys with their chairs against the wall, all tilted against the wall. It was like walking into a Clint Eastwood movie. You know? And they all, you know, I thought they all gave me the stink eye, but I'm probably wrong on that. But I found that the longer I stayed in that room, the better I felt, and the more welcome I felt, and the more loved that I felt. And it changed my life. It is changing my life as I go. And now, you know, I have a sponsor in this program, Willie, who actually chose me, which is a kind of turnaround, you know, but I was taking a long time, and he invited me to his sponsee meeting, and I didn't know why I was at a meeting at somebody's house, and I finally said, what is this meeting for? And he said, well, for all the guys I sponsor. And I said, does that mean you're sponsoring me? He said, only if you ask me. So I did. And I've been working the 12 steps in this meeting for about 13 years now. I'm not all the way through yet, but I'm getting there. And I'm going to go through the 12 steps with you now, and as they mean to me. I had to admit that I was powerless over the alcohol that affected my family. And I now have to admit that I'm powerless over the mental illness that affects my stepdaughter. I had to surrender the ability to make any kind of change in their lives and in my stepdaughter's life. I don't have control over her disease. And there's a lot that I have to let go. I came to believe in a power greater than myself. My family didn't believe in God. My father had had some terrible experiences in his life, and the subject of God was pretty much a joke in my family. When I was a lot younger, they used to drop me off at church and then take off. I guess they figured, you know, he's young, he needs the influence, you know, and then they'd pick me up and I'd come back. But I've slowly gone from that state to having, you know, a belief in a higher power. My higher power is the real world, and the people in this room. And I connect with my higher power every day, or I try to. And I think that my higher power does help restore me to sanity. I made a decision to turn my will and my life over to my higher power instead of trying to just use willpower to get through life. Willpower has never done anything for me. If you set Haagen-Dazs ice cream in front of me, I'll eat it. You don't have any. when I was a kid, I would eat a quart of ice cream, you know, if I could find it. And I was very overweight. So my willpower is just really not there. But I don't have to have willpower. I can turn that over. I can let go of that. I made a searching and fearless moral inventory of myself. I've done it a couple of times. And every time I've done it, it's a catalog of the good and the bad in my life. And it's painful to do. It was painful to get ready for this because I had to go over all that stuff again. And I didn't really want to drag that out and show it to you. But I can't think of a better room to do it in. It's just shameful. I admitted to God, to myself, and to my sponsor the exact nature of my wrongs as I know them. My family's role was to defend actions at all costs. My dad would go out to collect a bill and he'd come back with a black eye. And then nobody would say anything about it. It was like he's sitting there with a black eye and nobody would say a word. You know, nothing happened. Or something would happen, like the dog would die and my sister and I would be crying and my dad would say, okay, that's over now, let's go eat dinner. You know, my family had no tools for dealing with emotions. They didn't know how to deal with emotions. They could deal with a broken pump or a blown engine, but emotions were just baffling to them. And that partly that's, you know, what they came, what their baggage was. And admitting to their wrongs was just completely off the shelf. Forget it. I was entirely ready to have God remove my defects of character. You know, I had to read this one carefully. I haven't looked at this one for a while. And this was always a hard one for me because I thought, you know, I still have my defects of character. God hasn't taken them away, you know. Maybe he doesn't like me or something. But you know what it really says? It's very interesting. It says that you must fully accept who you are today. Let God remove those defects. It's not that God's going to remove them. It's that you are willing to let God remove the defects, which is, I cling to my defects. I understand that now. You let go of all that stands in the way of recovery. And that's really what that step's about. It's a commitment to not put stumbling blocks in yourself, to not put barriers in front of yourself to recovery. And I try to do that. I try not to put things in the way of my recovery. I humbly ask them to remove my shortcomings. And this step, to me, is all about humility. Humility was sorely lacking in my family. And humility was sorely lacking in me. You know, it's one of those things that makes it possible to live. If you don't have humility, you become so rigid that it's like the story about the difference between the green willow and a bunch of dry sticks. If you're so rigid, then you can be shattered. If you're a green willow, you can flex with the wind. I made a list of all persons I had harmed, and I became willing to make amends to them all. This would also be incomprehensible to my family. My father never said he was sorry to anybody. He would kind of crawl away and hide. That was his way of dealing with apologies. He did, when he was a lot older, before he died, he made some apologies. But most of his life, he was pretty rigid about that. You know, it's part of accepting people to be able to make amends. Made direct amends to those people whenever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. I have made direct amends to my parents. I have made direct amends to other people in my life. And I have more people to make amends to. This is the step I'm stuck on right now. The son that I have, I haven't seen him for many years. We were in a situation where most of the time my ex-wife was raising my son. And that situation made it more and more difficult. And I made it more and more difficult too. I wasn't in a place where I could really be a father to him. And I know that at some point I will have to make those amends. And I'm afraid to, because I'm afraid of the reaction. But you know I'm going to do it anyway. And Willie's going to give me a hand. And I need to make amends to my wife too, because a lot of things have been bad for her. And a lot of things I've done have been bad. But, you know, I'm working on that. That's part of my process. And I also need to make amends to my sister. I haven't seen my sister for a while. Although I love her, she's a difficult person to be with. She's not at all like I am. She's a different person. And sometimes she's a real challenge. But I know that there are things that I have to make amends to her about, too. I continue to take personal inventory, and when I'm wrong, I try to promptly admit it. I use this as a tool all the time. I use it at home, I use it at work, and it's never failed. I look at the situation and I try to see what my side of it is. And I always have a side. Even if I've been wronged, there's this part of me in that. And, you know, I was in a bank one time, and I was in a pretty bad mood. And I came in there, and I was talking to the teller, and we weren't getting along. And I was challenging her about some kind of deposit that I thought should have been, you know, credited earlier and all this stuff. And I was really being a jerk. And I got out my little piece of paper to be stamped for the parking validation. And I pushed it in front of her and I said, please stamp this. And she's pushed it back. And I thought, okay, I think I get it now. And I said, I'm very sorry if I've insulted you in any way. Please forgive me. And she said, she got a big smile on her face. She said, oh, can I stamp that? I got it. I get it. You know, when I'm that way with people, I'm letting myself down. I don't have to be that way with people. Even people that are angry at me, I don't have to be that way. I seek through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God as I understand him, praying only for knowledge of his will for me and the power to carry that out. I have taken a kind of spiritual journey. I have a different kind of spiritual discipline now that I had when I was a lot younger. And I study that spiritual discipline often because that is what I should do. And I know the difference between religion and spirituality. In my life, I need them both. Although I don't go to a church, I study my religion. And that will only get me so far. I also need spirituality. Spirituality is to be able to connect with my higher power. And I connect with my higher power by praying. Prayer to me is talking to my higher power. And I've had to learn how to do that. And a lot of you guys have taught me how to do that by listening to how you do it. It is a way of communicating without asking for anything. It's a way of communing by accepting. And the other way that I deal with my higher power is I meditate. Meditation to me is listening to what my higher power has to say. And I found that when I can turn off my thoughts, then I'm in direct communication. And that's a difficult thing. Meditation is not easy. I can only achieve it for a few minutes a day. But even that few minutes does enormous things. It really changes everything. And I find that I need that connection every day, because that is the real world. My thoughts are a construct of my language. My thoughts are a narration going on in my head that's based on language, that's a completely artificial world. When I can turn my thoughts off, then I'm in the real world. I'm where everyone else is existing. You know, my cat has more serenity than I have. And having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to others and to practice these principles in all our affairs. I reinterpret this for myself. My spiritual awakening are moments of clarity. And I get them more and more frequently now. There are moments where I can actually see what I need to do, and I can see what I don't need to do. And in the past, when I was so lost, I had no idea what to do. Somebody had to tell me what to do. Now, it's not the case. With this program, I get these moments where I know that I need to apologize to the bank teller right now. And plus, I never get my thing stamped. But that, to me, is a spiritual awakening. It's an awakening of the rightness of what I need to do to be here, to be in this world, to be a part of this world, to be able to love you, all of you, and myself. I can't love myself if I don't love you. I've been in this program here about 13 years, and it's an amazing place to be. I've done a lot of service in this meeting, and service is really a powerful tool. It puts you in contact with people automatically. When you can't do it yourself, if you're in service, it's being done for you. I was in this meeting one time, and we used to have these elections for people, you know, to serve in various posts. And we had one of these elections, and then if there are more than one person, they send everybody outside, and then they come back in, they tell them who won. And I lost the election, and I was really bummed. It was really kind of pissed me off, you know. And so I talked to Willie, and I said, there's nothing for me to do. He said, why don't you make something up? You don't have to do anything that somebody, you know, elects you to. And so I invented the taping thing. And and I get a lot of joy out of doing those tapes. They're not tapes, they're discs. What am I talking about? It's like the gramophone guy. But I get a lot of joy out of creating those recordings, because I can see all these different people. You know, it's amazing. It's like a record of all these different meetings. And sometimes I listen to the first part of it. It's very funny. There was one where somebody was singing before the meeting just to test the microphone. And I've had other ones, you know, where I catch a little scrap of conversation. Or my favorite's where Pat talks about the origin of this meeting. And I know that that's going to stay now. It's locked. It's locked up in time. We have that. We can always look at that. And that's really exciting to me. So let me look through my roadmap here and see where I am. My stepdaughter. My stepdaughter has a borderline personality disorder. Is that right? Yeah. Okay. She is a way different qualifier for me than an alcoholic. And I've learned this over time. And I've learned this through other programs. And her disease is cunning and baffling, and so is she. And I've learned to love her over the years of being her stepfather. But I've also learned that I have to be very, very careful with her, because her disease will cause dissension between myself and my wife. And I've learned a couple of little things. You know, one out of every five people is mentally ill. That's an enormous number of people. There's a lot of people. You know a lot of people that are mentally ill. And it's a different kind of situation when that person is your qualifier. One of the things that I've learned about Danielle is that for her, there is no bottom. She will go right down through the bottom and out into the floor. Our commitment to her is to support her in her recovery, in her becoming healthy. It's extremely difficult, and there are very many times when we don't believe anything good is happening, but we still try. But we also defend ourselves from her abusive behavior. And one of the things that I've learned is that my wife and I have to be united. We have to be united. If we allow her to separate us, we're lost. We can't help her, and we lose ourselves. So we work on that very carefully. When she calls me at work, when Danielle calls me at work, I immediately call my wife and I debrief. And she does the same thing. It's just part of making it work. And a lot of times it seems like a kind of war between her and us, but we keep after it. And you know, who knows? You know, I one of the things that my higher power doesn't give me is the ability to see the future. And there's a reason for that. I don't know what that is. But but I don't get to see what happens in the future. And if that's the case, I don't get to worry obsessively about the future, because it's none of my business. And I have to tend to my business. And so, you know, I try to look and see what's happening today. When I do my meditation, the prayer that I have said lately every morning is, God, thank you for this day. Allow me to make the very best of this day that I possibly can, to use it as wisely as I possibly can. And that's good for me. I need that. Because I don't know, you know? I don't know. There's a story that I like to tell about a Russian farmer. And the Cossacks lose some horses. And the horses come running through the village, and they go right into his corral. And right away, he's got four horses. And his neighbors come out, and they say, "Oh, you're so lucky. You've got four horses. Man, are you lucky." And he says, "Well, maybe." And so his son comes out, and he's riding these horses, and he breaks his leg. And the neighbor comes over, and he says, "Well, that's terrible luck. Your son broke his leg. Can't help you." He says, "Well, maybe it's bad luck." And then the Tsar's soldiers come by, and they draft all the young men in the village except his son, because he has a broken leg. And the Russian, and the neighbor says, "Wow, you're lucky." He says, "Maybe." Well, this goes on and on. This story goes on and on throughout your entire life. Maybe something that happens to you is unlucky. Maybe it's not. We're not allowed to know. My higher power doesn't let me know. My higher power's job for me is to accept this moment as being the best moment of my life. And this, accept the place where I am as being the best place for me, no matter how nasty or uncomfortable it is. And it's a job that I'm not very good at, but I'm working on it. So the last thing I want to talk about is sponsorship. Now, I have one sponsee. He's been my sponsee for many years. And I hardly understand what he says most of the time. But when he speaks, I understand what his heart tells me. And my philosophy on being a sponsor is that you do what you're ready to do when you're ready to do it, no matter how long it takes, no matter what it takes. So I will always be there for you until you're ready to work that blueprint for progress. You did buy the blueprint for progress. Yeah, okay, good. Very good. All right. Anyway, I can't think of much else to say other than I'm honored to be chosen to be up here. And, you know, I've been kind of switching back and forth between being terrified and dead calm. And but I've been dead calm all the time I've been up here, because I'm in a room of people that love me and care about me in a way that I've never been able to love and care about myself. So thank you for listening to me.